Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
We're kidding ourselves if we think people will stop talking.
You're one of the Monterey Five, right?
Monterey Five?
Just the way he said it, you know.
How did he say it?
Like the off-scarlet letters on our pecs.
It's gonna get us. It's gonna get us all.
What are you talking about?
Why?
Hello and welcome back to Still Watching Big Little Lies. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
Each week on the show, we break down the latest episode of Big Little Lies. This week, we will be discussing Season 2, Episode 2, The Telltale Hearts, which is directed, as they all are, by Andrea Arnold and written by David E. Kelley and Leanne Moriarty. This week, we have an interview with the lovely Crystal Fox, who plays Elizabeth Howard, Bonnie's mother. She's going to talk to us about her relationship to Zoe Kravitz and some of the things that this new generation of mothers brings to Big Little Lies. And before we get into all that, we have some emails from you guys, our listeners. If you want to write into stillwatchingpod@gmail.com and tell us all your thoughts, questions, gossip, concerns about Big Little Lies, we would love to hear them. We got a bunch of great emails this week. And I am going to start with this first one from Thomas. Thomas writes, I was curious as to whether either of you read any queer subtext in Big Little Lies Season 2, Episode 1. I'm thinking particularly of the outright camp of Renata lip-syncing Diana Ross in glitzy red couture, practically drag, but also Jane dancing on the beach to Mystery of Love with its inevitable Call Me By Your Name connotations, and the broader themes of trauma, solidarity, intersectionality, and fraught nature of sexuality, very queer relevant issues. I'm thinking too of a recent HBO Pride event where Drag Race queens dressed up as the Monterey Five. Are these purely incidental moments, or do they together speak to a broader, more deliberate choice by this show, headlined by cisgender heterosexual women, to embrace queer codes / conventions, or at the very least to entertain / pander to queer audiences? And that is from Tom. So I am going to ask you, Richard, what you think of that.
Why me?
I'll take this one, Richard.
I think that, there's definitely a queer read on the show. I don't know that it's necessarily overt, but, you know, I think that we're at the 50th anniversary of Stonewall, riots almost. We have like World Pride in New York. And so, you know, part of this sort of myth of Stonewall, which is probably apocryphal and not really true, is that it happened on the night that Judy Garland died. And Judy Garland was a gay icon because she was a woman who was dealing with a lot of struggle and men sort of imposing their will on her. And so I think gay people, especially gay men, saw a sort of commonality in that narrative. You know, and that's been the same way for many sort of diva worship, icons, from the gay community. And that travels all the way to Big Little Lies. Absolutely. I mean, I think you don't put Meryl Streep in a weird wig and false teeth and have her screaming, or Laura Dern doing a photo shoot, or whatever, you know, all the myriad of things that happen on this show or going to happen with the ice cream toss, you know, scene around the world, which we've yet to watch on the actual show. For sure. I mean, I think that there's an argument to be made that, like, anything is queer if you kind of want to bring a queer sensibility to it, unless it's overtly not. I would argue, like, Suicide Squad is not a queer movie, but, like, there is queer context, subtext, whatever, in lots of things. And Big Little Lies, it's almost overt.
Yes. I don't know what you think of the idea of pandering to. Like, do you think that there's any, like, queer baiting in the way that it's all sort of positioned?
No, I think it's a smart, entertaining show that tells an interesting story about interesting female characters and whoever that appeals to, be they queer or not, you know, whatever gender identity, whatever sexual identity they, you know, like, I think that it's just good television. And yeah, there's some stuff that's maybe speaks more directly to women or gay men or whoever else, but I don't see that as pandering. I see that as potentially making something for people, and there's nothing wrong with that.
All right, so then this next question comes from Andrea Jones, who writes in and asks basically about Maren Dungey's character, Detective Quinlan, who was sort of seen spying on the moms on the beach at the end of season one. We get a little bit of sort of hints of whether or not the detectives are still on the case. But the question Andrea asks is, were we meant to take that scene at the end of season one literally? Are we meant to take the detective and the idea of a noose closing in literally, or is any of this in Bonnie's head? Bonnie in this episode tells Madeline that she's afraid it's going to get them. And Madeline says what? And she says the lie. So it's like the lie. I thought I was clever calling this season the Telltale Heart season. And I just completely forgot that this episode was called the Telltale Hearts. So, like, you know, that's, which is a Edgar Allan Poe story about, you know, guilt, the murderer feels like they can hear the beating heart of their victim from under the floorboards, and that it will give them away. So, like, the, you know, it's not the crime, it's the cover up, as Richard said last week, etc. So how much are we supposed to take this detective sort of on the fringes of the narrative literally, or is any of this you know, invented, subjective? Richard, what do you think?
I mean, I take her presence at the beach watching them literally, but I think, I believe that Bonnie saw her. Baby was the only one, which is a nice sort of visual narrative device to, you know, further other Bonnie. I mean, this is a really big episode for her, and we see a lot more of that, and it's given more context, which I appreciated. But in the sole example of the detective, yeah, I think that's real. But, and I think the way it manifests itself in her sort of dream or anxiety states, maybe it's a little more overstated, or a little bit, you know, the contrast has been turned up or something. But no, I think this detective really is there, kind of lurking on the periphery, waiting to nail these
and
people.
And, you know, it should be, we had a little bit of, like, interrogation footage in the first episode, which we don't have in this episode. But I think that, that's something that I'm, without a spoiler, because I actually don't know, I've only seen the next episode and I have no evidence from that. But, like, it's something that I'm hoping will pay off and build this sort of, like, reviewing interrogation footage and stuff like that. So I think my guess would be, since Maren Dungey is, you know, in the cast for season two, we've seen her, like, that this will be something that will play a bigger part going forward. I think it is interesting. We've talked a lot about the use of race on this show, and it becomes more overt in this episode when Bonnie's mother comes to town and is like, I haven't seen anyone who looks like you, you know, sort of in this town. This last question comes from Joey, and Joey asks, this is a very Little Gold Men crossover question, but basically, how intentional do we think pushing Big Little Lies past the Emmy consideration window is? Was that the right move in this season? Will anyone remember Big Little Lies season two come next year, Emmys next year? Did they not want Big Little Lies trying to compete with Game of Thrones? What was happening there? And also, is there anyone, like, is it only Meryl Streep? I would argue in this episode, perhaps we might want to keep our eyes on Adam Scott for, like, sort of stealth awards consideration. So, like, what do you think awards-wise the strategy and the potential is for Big Little Lies season two, Richard?
Well, I think the number one priority was not overlapping with Game of Thrones, because why would you overlap your two biggest hit shows, you know? Like stagger them, you know, make sure they're not competing with each other, yes, first and foremost. And in terms of Emmy consideration, my guess would be that the sort of strategy people over there were like, well, look, we did really well last time. yes, it will be a full year away or whatever, but like plenty of summer shows do that. And, you know, some don't, like Sharp Objects didn't really, you know, maintain any momentum. Well, I guess we don't really know that yet, do we?
Well,
cause it would be this
for
year.
For Emmys. Yeah.
But like Golden Globes,
and, like,
it didn't
SAG
do very
and
well.
Stuff
yeah.
Like that, so, yeah.
Right. So, you know, but so again, so maybe I just disproved my points. Like I kind of forgot that Sharp Objects was still, but I don't know. I think that they trusted that second season, huge show, huge stars, even bigger star joining the cast. They'll be okay. And the most important thing requirement was met, which was that it didn't get in the way of Game of Thrones, and Game of Thrones did not get in the way of it.
And I think something that, you know, they could have pushed it all the way to fall, right? Perhaps. And, you know, to bring it closer in people's minds. But Big Little Lies feels like such a summer show to me. Like this, we're all like very lucky that the sun's out, the like, you know, the beverages are frosty, and we get to watch Big Little Lies. I think it is a summer show. So, that might be even more important to them than the awards that they might get from it. But
also going back to the first email, like releasing Big Little Lies season 2 featuring Meryl Streep during Pride Month is not a bad idea.
Right.
You know?
It's like Tales of the City.
Can't hurt.
Tales of the City is on Netflix and Big Little Lies is on HBO. Happy Pride.
Happy Pride. Exactly.
All right. Okay. And then like the last thing we want to do before we sort of zip through the episode and our thoughts on that is, you know, we've decided in our previous, you know, life as a Game of Thrones podcast, we gave out these awards. We don't want to give out the same award every week for Big Little Lies, so we decided to like come up with like rotating awards for the episode. So this week we just wanted to award the most meme-worthy moment. It's probably like if we were to do this every week, it would probably just be Laura Dern every week. So though it looks like Meryl Streep won the meme wars last week with her tableside scream. I don't know if I'm sure our listeners saw the edit of Shallow over Meryl Streep screaming. Is pretty my favorite meme of the week. So,
and there's like the Carly Rae Jepsen saxophone. The same person did that too.
Yeah.
It's very good. But yeah, we're gonna do superlatives. I mean, look, it's yearbook season, it's graduation season, so just think of it that way.
Most likely to succeed. All right, so this week is we're gonna put our chips on most meme worthy moment. So who has the most meme-worthy moment for you, Richard?
Well, I hate to be obvious, but Laura Dern screaming in a prison about how she's not going to be rich anymore is, I mean, you know, same, or, but I'm not rich now, but maybe hopefully me in 20 years or something. So that one probably takes my cake, though. I don't know how you could quite cut it into a gif that worked, but Reese Witherspoon walking away from Meryl Streep and just muttering weirdo, was a personal favorite. How about you?
That is a hard gif moment for sure, but, I'm like, how can I make this gif for Richard? I'll work on it. I'll make it for you. For me, it's also Laura Dern. It's gotta be, it's her driving away from her Tesla. In her Tesla, like middle finger extended out the sunroof after she's thrown her husband out of the car. And I think she says something like, you know, give a woman a moment or something like that. So anytime Renata screams, it's hard to.
Yeah. Give a woman a moment. That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
Yeah. So that's what we've got. I mean, like there's other stuff, you know, obviously like Meryl Streep saying like what she says, like, I don't like you or something. I mean, she just says some stuff that you're like, wow. So if you guys disagree with us, please email stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Let us know what you think your meme worthy moment is. I will be curious. I'll be watching the memes this week to see if people picked up on anything other than Laura Dern screaming, but it's hard to beat it. It's also, I mean, Richard rejected my suggestion we do Best Dress, but I'm going to sneak this in anyway and just say that like Laura Dern's outfit when, Renata's outfit when her husband gets arrested, which is this like insane puffy vest, belted puffy vest over like Chanel pants with like a Chanel bag or maybe fanny pack is, or no, Louis Vuitton pants and like a Chanel bag. Anyway, it's one of the craziest things I've ever seen. And I saw her in that red sparkly number last week. So, you know, keep your eye on Renata's fashion, but. All right. Let us get to the episode, itself. I actually kind of want to begin at the end just because I'm afraid I'm going to forget it. I don't know how many people listening binge watched season 1 to refresh themselves since it's been like, you know, nearly 2 years since it was last on. But the closing song choice is a cover of the Elvis Presley song, The Wonder of You, which of course is what, Adam Scott's character, Ed, sang, or Adam Scott lip synced. It was someone else singing for him, at the talent show last year. And it was like such a powerful moment in season one, because this is a love, you know, the lyrics of The Wonder of You. It's such a like tender love song dedicated to his wife. And she, you just watch Reese Witherspoon under the glare of all that like affection crumple with her own guilt of knowing that she's had this sort of extramarital affair. So I thought that was a really, snappy choice, to close out the episode after Ed has had his big moment. I guess I want Richard to hear your thoughts on like, Ed throughout, Adam Scott throughout. This is just like a real, he was a great supporting player in season one. He's great again here, but like this feels like the most he's gotten to do. What do you think of all the Ed of this episode?
Well, I think it's a really interesting character because I can't quite get a read on him, which is sort of true to real life. You know, he seems like kind of a jerk sometimes. He seems very like, in the right for feeling wronged. Other times he's kind, he's a little cold, like he just feels like a full person. And I think that's why it's a really interestingly written character and a really interesting performance. And you know, with the stuff in this episode, with this kind of convenient daughter blurting out that Madeline had an affair and he overhears, and you're like, wow, this is really melodramatic. In the same episode where Renata's husband gets arrested, I was like, sure, a lot of things sure are happening. But then the way that the show kind of always does is by the end, when that song is playing and it's back to the sort of Jean-Marc Vallée-esque, you know, quick cuts and ruminative little scene, you know, shots, it absorbs that melodrama and makes you feel something sort of more real. You know, it's remarkable the way that this show can serve you up such a sort of high calorie meal, but then afterward you don't feel gross or overstuffed or whatever. It just feels exactly proportional. It's a weird bit of alchemy or, you know, wizardry that this show can do.
Yeah. And I think also that scene he has where he, you know, declares their marriage over, and you know, he allows the hurt in his voice, he like, you know, he wobbles a bit. And I think I'm influenced by the fact, you know, I've seen Adam Scott in a number of things. I knew him from Party Down before I knew him from Parks and Rec. I've seen a lot of his like, you know, indie films or even like Step Brothers and stuff like that. We've seen Adam Scott do a lot of things, but his most iconic role is Ben Wyatt, like loveliest boyfriend slash husband in the whole world on Parks and Recreation. The last time I think I remember Ben Wyatt crying was like the wedding episode of Parks and Recreation. So when I hear Adam Scott like put some water in his voice, immediately hit me like really hard. And I think it hits Madeline too. And I like that, you know, this is once again, we talked about this last week, like Reese Witherspoon wanting something maybe a little juicier than Madeline is. And the, you know, Madeline is maybe a little one note, you know, Tracy Flick-esque in the book. And she wanted a little bit more drama, for her character. And so they added the extramarital affair in the first season. And so then this fallout, I mean, all of this season is added, but like this fallout is sort of the natural extension of that. And I really love it. I really, really love it here. And to then compare this fallout to, you know, the other battles Madeline's fighting, like with her trying to get her daughter to go to school, getting Abigail back home with her, so her conversations with Bonnie, and then her conversations with Mary Louise, which is just someone calling her out on her shit in a way she's not used to. What do you think of like Madeline's whole journey in this episode?
I think it's interesting. I think that Madeline is, I mean, yes, she had the concrete things of the affair, and now with her daughter, and now her husband finding out about the affair, like that, and obviously the murder. So those are plot points for her character to sort of be arranged around. But unlike, certainly Bonnie or Celeste, who had distinct sort of, I guess, narrative guidelines, the Madeline character always felt a little more looser. She was kind of just like in scenes, but none of the scenes were really about her story. She was just kind of reacting to Celeste's story and to an extent Bonnie's story, Jane's story. Right. And so I think now that she's getting a little more focus, it's interesting. And Reese Witherspoon plays it really well. Again, I get a little bit skittish about adding too much to the mix, you know, too many kind of dramatic plot developments. Again, the show handles those well and can absorb some of that. But I don't know, given that this is just the second episode of this season, and granted it's a short season, it's like, well, where do we go from here? I hope it doesn't get right. too more high drama.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I don't know if we can promise you that. Yeah. So the Madeline moment that like really struck me, and this speaks to, this is a, like, I would say this is a Bonnie episode. And so I kind of want to like finish with Bonnie. So we'll get to Bonnie eventually. The Madeline moment that really struck me is, you know, she goes to pick up Celeste, no questions asked. Celeste in like an Ambien haze has crashed her car. She picks her up in the robe. She's there for her. She's supportive. She sees Bonnie on the side of the road. She pulls over. She sort of begins interrogating Bonnie, like, where are you going? What are you doing? Get in the car. And then she goes, are you on drugs? You know, and then Bonnie has the great, like, are you on drugs? Like, fantastic retort. Mm-hmm. But like, they drive away and, you know, Madeline's essentially like, she's unraveling. I can't believe it. Can you believe it? All the while Celeste is like sitting next to her in the car, like having driven her car into a tree on drugs, you know, like she's right. literally the person on drugs. And so this idea, once again, it's like, the insider outsider thing, you know what I mean? And it's like, there's the circle the wagons aspect, that happens around the core group of large, you know, of white women in this town. And then there's like, Madeline wants to circle the wagons with Bonnie because they're all sort of complicit in this one thing. Bonnie is resistant to that. And so she's still getting the outsider treatment and the suspicion and all of that. And that's really fascinating to me.
Yeah, and it's then, well, you know, complemented by the stuff with Bonnie and her mom, Elizabeth.
Yeah. All right, so I want to hop over to that, but really quickly I want to touch on Jane and this other really profound moment of the episode, which is Jane having to tell her son, Ziggy, who his father is, first of all, which he already knew, and also kind of the nature of how he was born. This is a scene that really highlights the power of good child actors and really quiet moments. Like we talked about the melodrama. This is a melodramatic moment. Like this woman has to tell her son about, you know, what assault means and stuff like that. That's melodramatic, who your father is, all that sort of stuff. But it's so quietly done in this very like, intimate, tucked into bed sort of moment. And, I'm wondering if that helps you, Richard, calibrate some of the like Laura Dern shrieking. Does this quieter moment sort of counterbalance that for you?
Yeah, I think that moment was really well done. And I think Shailene Woodley is giving a really interesting, good performance. I liked her last season. I know some people were a little bit on the fence about her performance, but I think she's really grown into it, as I think Zoe Kravitz has, which we'll talk about. But, yeah, I like that moment. And I also think that the way that it then rippled into Celeste's life, where, you know, you saw a glimmer of her sort of self-protection when she said, we promised we wouldn't tell them. And Jane says, well, look, what was I supposed to do? Like, I can't keep lying to him. And then the way that, Celeste just kind of tells Mary Louise about it. And you get to this scene that's in medias res where she's already sort of said to her mother-in-law, it was a rape. It was, you know, he abused me. And she's just kind of repeating the points to a disbelieving Mary Louise. And I thought that the show was going to build to some huge reveal of that where Mary Louise would be so shocked and whatever. And I like that they actually went the more downbeat sort of off rhythm route with that. Because it just further complicates this whole dynamic between these women, and this new character. So yeah, I didn't expect for all of that stuff to come to light in terms of parentage and past abuse and all that in the second episode of the season. But now that they have, it leaves me all the more curious where they travel with that from here.
Yeah, I'm really fascinated by Meryl Streep's line reading of I don't believe you, where she just goes, I don't believe you. Like, and mm-hmm. it was like very interesting because to deliver that line, to have a woman say like, your husband beat me, and for the line in response to be like, I don't believe you. There's a lot of different ways that you could play that. And Meryl Streep decided to put some light, or Andrea Arnold, I don't know who decided this, but like to put an interesting amount of lightness on it. You know what I mean? Because like, and even the parts where Mary Louise talks about going to, you know, the cops and filling in the details of like, you left this out, you left that out, you left that out, didn't you? All of that could have been so much more menacing. But I think, as you say, we're in episode two and they're trying to calibrate this sort of like, it's not a definitive break between Mary Louise and Celeste here. It's a progression of a conversation, but it's not, I'm closing the door on our relationship because you told me this, and I think maybe you killed my son, like all of that. It's not quite there. Do you know what I mean?
I do. And I think that the I don't believe you, that's a little bit sing song. What that was communicated to me was Mary Louise saying, well, maybe something happened, but I'm sure it wasn't that bad.
Right. You didn't go to the
cops.
I don't
think she was saying flat out, you're completely making this up.
Yeah.
I think it was more like, oh, don't be, you're exaggerating, you know? Which I think is a much more believable stance for this woman who is both emotionally expressive in terms of screaming her lungs out at a, you know, to express grief in front of her family, and will speak plainly to Madeline about what she thinks about her. So she's not guarded in that way, certainly, but in other ways is clearly very tightly preserving a sort of myth of her son. And so it is sort of shut off to those realities, which is a, would seem a dichotomy that maybe couldn't exist in a person, but that absolutely does. And that's part of the way that these cycles of abuse are perpetuated across generations, is that unfortunately there are people on the sidelines who do a really hard, you know, do a lot of work to, you know, blind themselves to it or obscure it somehow or minimize it in their mind. And so that might manifests itself, you know, verbally by like, oh, I don't believe you, you know, because you have to dismiss it so lightly because otherwise it really threatens the world you've kind of created for yourself.
Yeah. And it's really fascinating to watch then Celeste talk to the twin boys, who once again, I really think those two boy actors, along with, Ian Armitage as Ziggy, like have really kind of come leaps and bounds from season one, but to talk to them about Perry and say, no, he was a wonderful, beautiful man. And then she says, the word she uses is weak. He could be weak sometimes, like uh-huh. all of us, but he was a wonderful, beautiful man. It's such a hard scene to watch because you like both understand why she would want to preserve that for them. And it's hard to hear the villain of season one talk to them. And it's one thing for Mary Louise to do it, but for Celeste to do it. And you already called out that scene that she has with Jane where you're like curious. You're like, how will her, you know, her allyship with Jane stand the test of, you know, the pressure from Mary Louise and the desire to, you know, make Perry not a monster for her own boys and stuff like that. And how does that all end? And then you see this final montage of like the weird little family kind of coming together and how much that means emotionally for Jane. And how much the boys are just being nice with each other and how sweet it is. I don't know. It's all so, I think, beautifully complicated and well calibrated for Celeste.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, it's not following exactly the contours that I thought it would. And I appreciate the surprise of that. And, you know, in the same way that like I was worried that the therapist scenes with Celeste would be feel redundant this year because so much has already been expressed and in some senses, in a physical form, at least the problem has been dealt with. But they are finding new, interesting angles of inquiry there. You know, so. I don't know. I'm pleasantly surprised. I think this episode contains a lot, you know, and whether I find all of it happening within the same day sort of really credible, I don't know. But
sure. Well, but whatever. Yeah. I mean, you talked about melodrama, so like let's revisit really quickly my favorite segment, which is Dr. Amanda Reisman, best therapist or worst therapist, terrible therapist? ? So that's Robin Wiegert's character, and in this scene we get her taking Celeste sort of on a thought experiment, which is like, what if you put Madeline in your own place? You know, in an example of when Perry beat her up, in the closet. It punched her in the stomach. And you get this very guttural screams of like, no, from Celeste, which you then get repeated sort of when she's breaking up the fight with her boys. No, you will not be like him, sort of thing.
Yeah.
So how does this read to you? You've already said you think this is like good territory for the therapy session to revisit, but like, you know, for me, this is the only moment Nicole screaming, Celeste screaming, no, it's the only moment that felt like, okay, maybe this is a little too much, for me. But then again, trauma's trauma. You know what I mean? And we cope with trauma how we cope with trauma. So, what did you think of the therapy session in that regard?
Yeah, I thought it was powerful. I thought it was well acted. Yeah, like anytime someone's going to shout like that in a semi-public space, I'm like, I wouldn't do that. But, you know, again, I'm not in the same position by any means. I think that what that scene and the way that it is, particularly the way it's echoed later when she breaks up the fight between her sons, and then you have Jane worrying about Ziggy and you have Madeline looking at her daughter and wondering what's to come of her. And you have, you know, her other daughter, getting in the mix, that everyone now is turning to realize, oh, everything we're doing or everything we've experienced is having some bearing on our children. And the sort of the mounting panic of that, mm-hmm. and the undercut with the worry that it's maybe too late, is constricting in the best possible way. I mean, it's just really closing in on the show like a vice. And I really, I think that that's a really interesting and, underexplored maybe, device for drama, you know? And, if that's kind of where the season is looking in general, now, especially that you have this looming mother figure entering the picture from a different generation to kind of explain one of the major characters from last season or put him in a new context, I'm into all of that and all the way that it interrelates, in this cloistered, very self-congratulatory, helicoptery kind of world.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about another mother coming to town, which is sort of the plot line we've been circling, which is the expansion of Bonnie, Zoe Kravitz's character, is my favorite part of this new season. I think it's the most worthwhile reason to do a second season. And so we've got Crystal Fox as Elizabeth Howard and Martin Donovan as Martin Howard, her parents coming to town. The emphasis is on, Elizabeth, obviously, and her relationship with Bonnie. This is a story. This is tricky. We're not going to talk about book spoilers here, but this is like the last remaining book spoiler, from season one, that, you know, people might want to go read up on if they want, but those who've read the book, have extra information about Bonnie's relationship with her parents. So that is something that I'm really glad that they're visiting here. We first see Elizabeth, I believe, in Bonnie's rear view as she's driving. This car is behind her. Maybe it's supposed to be I'm actually not sure perhaps it's supposed to be Mary Dungy's character, but like there's a figure behind her. I immediately assumed it was her mom on second rewatch, but, I'll have to go look closer, but, this idea of Bonnie being caught off guard, feeling like hunted, feeling like accosted when she's at yoga, like her happy place. And her mom shows up and she's like immediately discomfited. And this mom, her mom is here with her opinions, with a implication of a drinking problem and with crystals, and Bonnie wants her gone sort of immediately, so much so that she's willing to like literally like cozy up to Nathan, someone she's felt estranged from, to get him to remove her mother from the situation. So what do you think of this other mother coming to town and this, glimpse into Bonnie's family life?
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You can earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City Branch. subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Well, I think the smart way that you handle a second season like this is you have to, I mean, some shows do it less successfully, like The Tailies and Lost, but you have to introduce new people who can observe what you've accepted as the reality of the show and then comment on it and change things,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I think the introduction of both of these mother figures has been really interesting in that regard. I think Crystal Fox is so good that I really want to see more of her. And, you know, despite what I think could be read as perhaps a little bit of a stereotypical thing regarding race and ethnicity with her doing this sort of witchy stuff with crystals and a feather and a bone, I think it was. I thought that that added this really interesting element of not the supernatural by any means, but something spiritual almost, you know?
Yeah.
Which the show is sort of not, does not really have. I mean, they have their own sort of religion, but that's more sort of money and, you know, status and all that. So I like that aspect of it. And I like someone speaking plainly, though they weren't trying to frame her as a savior character because she clearly has her own issues or past or present. But the way that it gives Bonnie more context is great. And that Zoe Kravitz really rose to meet the material was great. I thought she was, I think she's very good in this episode. And I think that scene where she has with James Tupper where they're fighting, Bonnie and her husband, and you realize like, well, why are they together? But you kind of still get it because they're both hot and they like, you know, like whatever, like it, like it, I just think it, you know, as with, Madeline and her husband, like I think that these relationships, though existing in sort of extreme circumstances, are really credible in the way that you feel really ambivalent looking at them. Cause you're like, that's good. That's bad. Why does this work? Oh, I see kind of why it works. And even, you know, Elizabeth, Bonnie's mom, she's not outright saying that her daughter should leave her husband or whatever. She's just kind of, she's prodding the relationship to be better. And I think that that's a really interesting way to play with the dynamics that were already set up so well in season one.
And it's these women, these mothers coming in and doing some like, you know, perhaps, or whether or not we're meant to take it that way, truth telling perhaps about certain characters. So like you have Mary Louise calling out Madeline and then you've got Elizabeth calling out Nathan and being like, you, well, that's what you're oblivious. That's what you are. You know what I mean? Like that's, she just says this stuff at dinner and it's just sort of like, okay, this is where we are. So yeah, I think it's an incredible new variables to bring into the mix here. I think the questions around how much of Bonnie's resistance, you know, is due to her frustration that even if she wanted to, she couldn't tell her mother the whole truth of what's happening, and how much of it is also, is just a true born out of a bad, you know, because we don't know what her relationship with her mother was like growing up, but we do know that her mother at least once upon a time had a drinking problem. You know what I mean? So, that's, you know, that's just all really rich material to explore and really rich material for Zoe Kravitz, who once again, I felt was done a little dirty by the first season and is getting a lot more rich material to work with. And really, as you say, rising to the occasion, the like, the sort of sleepwalking nature of some of her scenes. And then when her like sort of internal fire flares up, that calibration, I think, is my favorite thing to watch this season. So I really like it. And you mentioned really briefly, like sort of the idea of the spiritual. Bonnie's mom also mentioned that she has visions. She has visions of someone drowning. We get a flash of water. What do you think of that, element of it?
I like that kind of portent. I think that that whether or not it's going to be literal, I mean, water is certainly like we, you know, a motif on this show in a big way. So maybe it's just speaking more to that, or maybe it's a more metaphorical drowning. But I like a sort of, I guess you could call it a different worldview, you know, where Elizabeth seems to have a different approach and philosophy and ideology about the way the world works, and what is perceptible and what's not, you know, and to shake, you know, at least one character out of the stupor of this show with its rhythmic sounds of waves and its shots of a gray sky and its kind of wandering camera. Like you get, it's hypnotic. And I think someone, even if she's coming at it from a sort of woo-woo spiritual place herself, shaking someone out of that trance is interesting to watch.
Mm, I like that. I hadn't thought of like the whole town itself as sort of lulling you to sleep with the waves and stuff like that. So, and the danger of the water. We talked about the water motif. This is something that I noticed in the first watch through of the season. And the first time I watched through like the first three episodes that we have, like, I noticed how often Bonnie is drinking water. And I just thought maybe that was supposed to be like, oh, well, she's an incredibly healthy person and she's constantly hydrating. And I was like, I should hydrate more. Like, that was sort of my takeaway. This time, though, I'm watching through. I'm like, well, maybe this is something else at play here. And maybe they're trying to, like, mm-hmm. say something about the water that's constantly being ingested by Bonnie. The way, you know, her mom says you're drowning in a way. Like, she underlines the metaphor there. But, like, the idea that Bonnie is constantly just swigging water is interesting to me. So something to keep a Bonnie water watch 2019 is something I'm willing to embark upon. All right, is there anything else we want to talk about in this episode?
I think we've covered everything. I mean, I would stress again, if someone can figure out a way to make, well, I mean, I know that you can, but you're busy, to make really good gifts of the moments we've mentioned. We welcome all forms of memery.
I do welcome a meme. You can tweet at us, or you can email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We'll get to our Twitter handles at the end of the episode. But first, let us go to our discussion with the great Crystal Fox. So I'm curious what you can tell, you know, people listening to this will only have seen up through episode two, your first episode. But with that in mind, what can you tell Big Little Lies fan about your character, Elizabeth, and what she brings to the show?
That's the interesting thing. A lot of things I have to keep hush until I see it. I haven't seen any of the performances yet. I'll see it when the public sees it on Sunday. However, the little I can say is that I think you'll see where Bonnie gets, where she comes from. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The apple doesn't fall too far from the tree. And her mom is grounded. She's kind of a earth woman.
Well, so to maybe give you some context, help you out since I have seen the episode, there's this great dinner scene with you, Nathan, Bonnie's husband, and then your husband, Martin, played by Martin Donovan, sort of all around the dinner table. And there's an implication in that scene that your character had a history with alcohol and is maybe sort of veering back that way or not. I think when we meet Elizabeth this episode, we're supposed to have questions, but not have decided one way or another whether Bonnie's resistance to her has to do with Bonnie's state of mind or whether or not Elizabeth wasn't a great parent after all. Do you know?
Yeah. Now, they show this in the second episode?
That dinner. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow. That's incredible. That's good to know. I'm just fascinated. I'm like, what, really? I remember that. I thought it would probably have been near the end. That's awesome. Okay. Well, this is the thing. Bonnie is so reserved that I think you wonder when parents come into the scene, you wonder if they're just going to be there to be a rock. Is the person going to lean on them or not? And Bonnie's so strong-willed that I think you'll see that her mom brings out that resistance in her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they'll explore why and how.
I like that answer. I know
relationships. Yeah. Because relationships can be complicated. A lot of times we just hear, oh my goodness, my relationship is so great with my mom and my dad, but you very rarely get to see complicated relationships played out in real life.
Yeah. Something I love is this introduction of your character and Meryl Streep's character. We get this added layer above of mothers, another generation of mothers above sort of the generation we met last season. What do you think?
Exactly.
Yeah. What do you think bringing that perspective into, like, I guess something it does accomplishes is turn these women who we think of as mothers into daughters as well. You know, so what does that do to the story and the narrative as a whole to turn these mothers into also daughters?
Well, one thing that I loved about Big Little Lies is that when you first start watching the episodes, take Nicole Kidman's scene. I thought they had such a loving, sexy relationship. Right. And then you get into it and you're just, it felt like I my mouth stayed open for the remainder of the season. Yeah. Just watching them, you're like, what? Oh my goodness. What? Isn't that amazing? What our perception is at first, and then what it really, what the reality is. I was given this great phrase from the bishop of my church, and that was, you know, perception is greater than reality. And a lot of times that is the truth. It's not the truth. It's just greater than reality. And yeah, my perception was one thing and the reality was a whole nother thing. All of that to say, that is another layer of what I think the moms bring. You sometimes you almost automatically want to blame someone for their parents or on, you know, how you are or your who you become on the parents. But I think they will become like a mirror so you can see, is it the parents' fault or is it who you chose to become as a result of who your parents were?
Yeah.
But ultimately, the decision ends up being up to you as to who you decide to become.
One of my favorite parts of this episode is you've got this sort of hiking scene with Bonnie. You guys are hiking in the woods. And you call out something that I think was sort of implicit in the first season, which is that, like, the whiteness of Monterey and the fact that Bonnie doesn't look like the other mothers felt like part of the reason why she was shunned to a certain degree in season one, but it was never stated. And then you go ahead and call out the fact that there are so many white people in Monterey and Bonnie is automatically on the outside because of that. What do you think about the way that the first season treated, you know, the question of race in Monterey versus how the second season is dealing with it?
Well, the interesting thing was that was very important for Zoe that was mentioned or dealt with. That was kind of, I think, my first day or first or second day working. And that was something that they wanted to cover. I don't recall them dealing with that at all in the first season.
Yeah.
In this season, I think it's good. Well, one, that once I appear, you do see the distinct difference, I think, more. And the fact that I ask about it brings attention to it. Another thing that I think it does is it leaves this question mark, too. Is that something that she did or she chose to do, that Bonnie chose to do on purpose, to go live somewhere where she's not, where she's kind of a singular figure, to have her own life away from her mom?
Right. Yeah.
And anything that reminds her of her mom, you know, I wonder.
Yeah, that's a very good question. You mentioned that this is important to Zoe, and my perception of Big Little Lies is that more than most shows, it allows the actresses or the performers to weigh in on the way in which their story is told. What have you observed about sort of the collaborative process between the main cast and the script?
Oh, it seemed to be fully open and accessible for everyone to create and to make suggestions and to explore. So that just seemed to be a given across the board for everybody.
Is that different from most sets you've been on or similar to some?
Fortunately for me, that's been the case, is that has been allowed and encouraged wherever I worked. And I love that because I come from theater and it is total collaborative. It's a total collaborative effort.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. One thing I've also heard about Big Little Lies is that there's a good deal of improv. Was that true of your scenes as well with Bonnie?
Some. Well, you do the basis of what is scripted and then you play. So that was allowed a lot, especially with Andrea, our director. She loves music, and a lot of music was on the set all the time. So there would be times where you'd be doing something and you just finished the scene and this song would pop up and people would just instinctively start dancing. And it was just a lot of fun.
That sounds lovely.
just a lot of fun. So I don't think that those things made it to the scenes, but it helped inform the scene sometime, and make heavier moments lighter.
Yeah, that must be necessary to navigate some of the stuff that happens in Big Little Lies. There's also part of this episode where your character sort of lays down a crystal and some other objects sort of by the character while she's sleeping. And then Bonnie gives it back and says, like, I don't want any of this, like, shit in my life, basically. Excuse my French. And this idea of visions of Elizabeth, your character, and visions. How seriously are we meant to take this? What do you think about adding this sort of spiritual element to Big Little Lies?
Yeah, it can be tricky. It can be very, very tricky. Because you may turn people off with it immediately. But I do believe that there are people that have seeing ability or healing abilities. And I think that Elizabeth has those. And I think that's what she's trying to just impart, is a sense of peace and healing around Bonnie. Because she sees that she is not handling things well.
The idea of, I've had a vision of someone drowning, and like, you're drowning in a way, like, sort of saying, mm-hmm. like, make it the metaphor explicit. There's so much stuff about, like, about water and waves and the ocean and Big Little Lies. And something I noticed, and I don't know, maybe you could tell me I'm crazy, but Zoe's character Bonnie is always drinking water. And I know that she's like the healthiest person on the planet and is always doing yoga and is like constantly hydrating anyway. But is there any sort of like intentionality around her constantly gulping water and this drowning sort of motif? Is that at all connected, or am I just reaching?
I absolutely wouldn't know.
Okay.
Now, Zoe would know, but I absolutely would not know.
That's fair.
That.
And then, yeah, you mentioned Andrea's directorial style and this idea of music and dancing, but I know it can be tough for a director to come into a project. I know you weren't on the first season, but I know Jean-Marc Vallée had such like a, you know, creative, you know, stronghold over the first season. Did you observe mm-hmm. anything about this, I don't know, passing the baton over to Andrea, the way that the cast treated her, or the way that, you know, she intentionally tried to match the style of the first season?
No, not that I know of. I don't think that she was trying to match it as much as when I saw some footage of her own piece. It was similar to me. I hope no one gets upset with me for that, but in look to me as Jean-Marc. So I felt that they just welcomed her with open arms.
Yeah.
We were all the newbies, but, she was so open, just as everyone was, to collaboration. She'd listen to people's suggestions, and it's kind of like, you know, this work. So you just kind of listen to the other people tell you, or ask you, or guide you in that same direction. Yeah, so it was just very open and very welcoming to her.
Well, so you mentioned also being welcomed with open arms. My question, you know, I know we can't sort of dig into it too much, but if your character's relationship with Bonnie is complicated, which it seems to be.
Yeah. Yes.
What kind of work outside of the performance do you do with Zoe to either, is it worth doing extra work to sort of create a bond, or since that bond is so sort of fractured and delicate and complicated, do you not want to bond too much off screen to create that sort of tension, you know?
I understand what you're saying. I work on another show as well, and I play another mom, mm-hmm. and me and my daughter have a really bad relationship. But I have to say, and I know some people would rather not bond with someone that they have to have a difficult relationship with. For me, it worked in the opposite way. I met Zoe and we clicked right away. And it's something about, to me, the safer you feel, I don't want to say easy because it's not necessarily an easy thing to do difficult or play difficult scenes, but the safer you feel with each other, the easier or more comfortable it is to go to those darker places.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Because you feel safe. Because more times than not, if you're with a giving actor like Zoe is, and my other co-star Tika Sumter, you just say, let's play, let's try different things. But you feel safe because you have some type of connection with each other. And then you can try anything because you know the intentionality is totally character based.
And then, you know, what can you, I guess I'll leave this last part up to you, and maybe that's not fair, but what can you say about your character, what you're excited for people to see from your character this season without spoiling anything about where it all is going to go?
Someone gave me a description in an interview that said, so we hear that Elizabeth is a nasty person. Oh. And I thought, nasty? I hadn't heard that. But I think that all people are capable of a nice nasty. There's the kind that you see, and then there's the part you don't see. The people that see that are like your family. But there's that cover-up.
Yeah.
And I think you might have seen a little bit of that at the dinner table.
Yes, absolutely. Nice nasty is what we have to look forward to.
You know what I mean? So I think you're going to see that. It's a little nice nasty.
You and Meryl both bringing the nice nasty to Monterey.
Yeah, okay. That's good. So I'm looking forward to seeing that. I think that's going to play out a lot.
All right, that brings us to the end of this episode. Next week, we'll be talking about episode 3, She Knows. Dun, dun, dun. Another ominous sort of episode. No, actually, sorry. Next week is called The End of the World, even more ominous. The End of the World, coming next week. And then still somehow 4 more episodes to go after that. Richard, until next week, where can people find you?
I mean, maybe hanging around an aquarium, because I know that, like, Jane doesn't really seem to like this new love interest, Corey, but I think he's cute, so... You know, I'll take him off her hands if she doesn't want him. And then I'll also be on Twitter at Rylaz and on VF.com. Joanna, where will you be?
I will just be circling the block, screaming out the sunroof of my Tesla. Thank you so much for bringing up Corey. I'm ashamed that we forgot to mention him. He looks like he enjoys a kale salad. And what's not to love about someone who enjoys a kale salad? So hopefully we'll see more of cute aquarium Corey. You can also find me on Twitter at cute aquarium Corey. No, at Joe wrote this. Once again, you can email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We will see you next time.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.